From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Running the Iditarod, we talk with novelist Gary Paulson about why he took on the 1,200-mile Anchorage to Nome dog sled competition twice. The first time, he was voted the least likely to get out of Anchorage. Paulson is also a popular author of children's books. Also, playwright and actor David Drake performs excerpts from his one-man show, The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me. It's about being gay in America. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Ref, a new comedy starring Dennis Leary, Judy Davis, and Kevin Spacey. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The first of six White House aides subpoenaed in the Whitewater affair testified before a grand jury today. The Clinton administration also delivered a stack of related documents to the courthouse. The first to appear before the grand jury was Margaret Williams, chief of staff for Hillary Rodham Clinton. Mrs. Clinton's press secretary is also testifying today, as is Deputy White House Counsel Joe Klein. The Israeli government commission investigating the Hebron massacre was told today that Israeli soldiers in Hebron are under orders not to shoot Jewish settlers who fire at Palestinians. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
Members of the commission were visibly surprised to learn about the order not to shoot Jewish settlers, even if they are shooting at Palestinians. Meir Tayar, commander of the border police in Hebron, said the orders came from the commander of Israeli forces in the city. Tayar said the order meant even if soldiers had tried to stop settler Baruch Goldstein when he massacred Palestinians at a mosque in Hebron, they could have done nothing. Israeli soldiers shot and wounded at least 15 Palestinians in Hebron today during disturbances that began when a curfew was briefly lifted. The worst violence occurred at a Jewish enclave in the center of the city. Palestinians are demanding Israel dismantle the settlements in Hebron, and some Israeli cabinet ministers agree, saying that would reduce tensions. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
The government of the black South African homeland of Maputo-Tswana has apparently collapsed. Strikes and demonstrations broke out yesterday and today, protesting the president's decision to bar residents from voting in South Africa's April elections. He wanted Maputo-Tswana to remain separate. The president's whereabouts today are unknown. Thousands of people celebrated the government's apparent downfall. They were joined by many police and soldiers. A survey released at an American Medical Association conference today shows that American teenagers face high levels of violence. NPR's James White reports.
The survey, released by the Gallup International Institute, indicates that a large percentage of teenagers are at a great risk of danger from violent acts in places where they should feel the safest, most notably at school. More than half of the teenagers were physically assaulted by their peers, often with a knife or a gun. A fourth were set upon by posses or organized gangs. Some teens even reported high levels of sexual assaults. When confronted by violence, the majority said they sought the help of a trained counselor at school. Most said they were uncomfortable going to the police or a doctor. A national sample of more than 500 teenagers were surveyed over a four-month period last winter. I'm James White in Washington.
The Irish Republican Army has claimed responsibility for a mortar attack on London's Heathrow Airport yesterday. The IRA says it fired four mortars from a hotel parking lot. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 27 points. This is NPR. Labor Secretary Robert Reich today said President Clinton's health care reforms would not cost jobs. Reich told the Senate Small Business Committee that the Clinton plan would help, not hinder small business. The president wants employers to pay at least 80% of their workers' health insurance. Lawmakers said small business owners are worried about that, and their fears would have to be addressed. Senators said they were also concerned about how complicated the White House proposal is. Secretary of State Warren Christopher reports no progress in his trade talks with Japanese leaders. Christopher is in Tokyo as part of an 11-day tour of the Pacific Rim. He says Japan did concede its trade surpluses are hurting economic growth around the world. NPR's Marjorie Sun reports.
Christopher delivered basically the same message to Japanese leaders today that other U.S. officials have been stressing since trade talks between the U.S. and Japan failed last month. Under a so-called framework agreement signed last summer, Japan agreed to cut significantly its trade surplus. It also promised to set numerical targets to gauge the openness of its markets in several specific sectors. Today, Christopher seemed to broaden U.S. concerns about these stalled trade talks and what's at stake.
I feel at least that there's an issue of the credibility in carrying out agreements.
Christopher meets with Japanese business leaders tomorrow and is then scheduled to fly to China. I'm Marjorie Sun in Tokyo.
Japan's transport ministry today gave the Chrysler Corporation a waiver from a time-consuming inspection procedure for its Jeep Cherokee. Chrysler says the exemption could help double Cherokee sales in Japan. Japan is urging other U.S. automakers to apply for a similar waiver. Another major New England company has announced plans to cut its workforce. Fleet Financial Group of Rhode Island says it will eliminate about 5,500 jobs over the next year. That's about 19% of its workforce. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscowane. As we speak, a group of wild and reckless men, women, and dogs are facing dangerous storms, bitter cold, and mind-blowing solitude in the wilds of Alaska. Last Saturday, the Iditarod began. It's a 1,200-mile sled dog race which runs from Anchorage to Nome. In 1983 and again in 1985, Gary Paulson ran the race. And what a ride it was. He writes in his new book, Winter Dance, "I knew nothing of Alaska, crossing mountain ranges, running on sea ice, 1,180 miles of snow and deep cold, cold like I had never even imagined, winds beyond belief, roaring waters and deadly dreams, a world, a whole world beyond my knowing." Paulson is well known to young readers for his many books about adventure and survival. He's won the Newbery Honor Award for Children's Literature 3 times for Dog Song, Hatchet, and Winter Room. Recently, he's been writing books for adults. Last year, Eastern Sun, Winter Moon told of his troubled childhood with alcoholic parents. And this year's Winter Dance is about his first Iditarod. At one point, Paulson had as many as 91 dogs. I asked him what made him decide to run the race.
It was not sane. I had been completely shattered financially. My wife and I went broke in Colorado, and we went to Minnesota to live in the woods and live off the land, and I started trapping for the state and for myself. I mean, it was a job. And Minnesota had a law that said you couldn't use a four-wheeler or a snow machine for trapping, so I was on foot. We didn't have a car. But somebody also knew that there was a statement in the law that says you could use a dog team. So somebody'd heard about me. They gave me 4 older dogs and a busted sled, which I fixed up. And I started using them for transportation. In fact, I got an Army training manual called Transportation, Dog, 1 each. And honest to God, and it was invaluable. It's just, it's a great book for anybody who's thinking about dogs. It tells you, I mean, how to take care of them and how to do things, is when to water them. I mean, just basics, you know, that a lot of people don't know.
When you were out running with these dogs and trapping and working together, was that when the idea of the Iditarod came to you?
What happened was I came off a long run. I'd been on the trap line, and I'd quit trapping because I decided that it was not correct to kill animals, and I'm not going to get into a big controversial thing, but for me, it's not the right thing to do. I'm a vegetarian now. And I had quit that, and I had not told anybody that I'd quit trapping because I loved running dogs so much. And I was on a long run. It was a seven, almost an 8-day run. And as I was coming home off this run, I crossed a lake in the moonlight. It was about 30 below. It was midnight. Beautiful full moon. And when dogs run, they're silent. They never make a sound. And as I crossed the lake, at the end of the lake, I went up through these trees, and their breath inverted and came over their backs, the steam. And it hid the dogs, and it was like I was being pulled by this silent steam ghost through the moonlight. God, it was beautiful. And at the top of this hill, there was a fork, and if I'd taken the trail straight home, it would have been about 2 hours, and I'd have been home with noise and people and everything. And if I took a right, I'd see it again. I hung a right, and I ran 5 or 6 days, 7 days. When I came off the run, somebody told me about the race, and I thought that the Iditarod must be the maximum expression of that beauty, that that running the dogs 1,180 miles, well, I thought it was 1049 then, but it turned out to be 1180. Running them 1,180 miles would all be beautiful. And by God, it was. I mean, I ran it twice, and it was all beautiful both times.
Now, I assume in assembling a dog team, personality plays a big part in it, about who's going to be the leader, who's going to follow the leader. How complicated is it to put together a team of dogs?
The first team that I ever ran when I was trapping, I didn't have a leader, and I tied a rope around my waist, and I was the leader, and I left the yard pulling these four dogs in the sled, and I thought, this is really stupid. It didn't accomplish anything. You know, I was still out in front of them somewhere. But then I found out one of the dogs wanted to lead. You could tell that this dog named Bea kept looking ahead, trying to get to over the next hill, and that's what a leader does. It wants to get out there and see what's ahead. And they don't all want to lead. Some of them would rather just run in the team. But the ones who want to lead will actually stand when you're stopped and jump up and try to see over the next hill, over the next rise. They'll actually try and see ahead. And you keep moving dogs forward till the leaders kind of select themselves. It's not a social thing. It's not the pack structure and all of that. That's Jack London was, I don't think he ran dogs very much.
Well, when you're with doing the Iditarod or with a team of dogs, who's the boss, you or the lead dog?
It depends on how you look at it. It's a shared responsibility. An interesting situation develops in that the person can think they're in charge, but the truth is that dog out in front can kill you. Has to know where to go to avoid bad ice and to handle situations that occur before the human gets there. So the dog really, the lead dogs are really kind of the bosses. And it's all a shared thing. It's very friendly and all that. It's not a competitive thing. But I learned finally that when I made a decision to do something, it was almost invariably wrong and we would get lost. And if I allowed Cookie, who was my leader in my first race, the primary leader, if I allowed her to make the decision, we were almost always right. And so I finally shut up and let Cookie run the show, and she took me to Nome.
How did you communicate with your dogs? Did you ever develop a kind of a growling that they understood?
Yeah, you get to where you can growl at them. I'm not sure that, yeah, you do. I mean, you can stop a fight sometimes. If a couple of dogs start fighting, you can growl really, just, and they'll stop the fight. They know that you're interested in what they're doing. But you communicate in language. Cookie knew three names. She had a nickname of Ducks, and at one point I said, "What's up, Ducks?" And her tail wagged, so I started calling her Ducks. And then Mama, she had good pups and she was a good mother, so I called her Mama and she would wag her tail. She knew that she had three names, and you could communicate. And in her case, if I wanted to go right, I would say G or left was Ha, which is the standard terms. But if I said G a little, she'd go about 18 inches over.
Really?
Yeah. So I could go G a little, Ha a little, G a little, Ha a little, and go through a room full of furniture with her. She knew exactly what my voice meant when I did those things. She knew me better, I think, than probably anybody ever has.
Anybody, including your wife?
Yes. Yes. I spent 16,000 or 17,000 miles with her, with Ducks, before she got a little arthritis. And then I retired and brought her in the house, and she would sit next to me all the time in the house after she retired. If we were watching television, she'd sit on the couch next to me and not allow other people to sit there.
Hmm. Well, when you're training dogs for the Iditarod, do you bring them in the house? Do you give them special treats? Do you snuggle with them and do all the things that most families do with a family pet? Or is there something different you have to do?
I would not normally want them in the house because it's better for them to grow their hair if they're outside more. But I would go out and sleep in the kennel with them frequently. Sometimes when it was a warm day in the summer and everybody was just kind of lazy, I'd let them all go. And they'd all run to the house, and we'd bring 8 or 10 in the house at a time or whatever. We'd have to hide the cats first because they kept eating the cats. It's not good for house cats.
You mean literally eating the cats?
They would eat them if they caught them. Yeah, yeah. They didn't have they don't know the rules. They don't know that if a cat arches its back and hisses, that it means something. They just go ahead and eat it. So you have to be very careful about that.
You write about having some trouble, at least in the beginning stages of training your dogs, and you decided to sleep in the kennel with them. Actually, I think you had been sprayed by a skunk, and your wife suggested that you go, that you sleep in the kennel. But how did that change your relationship with them to sleep together?
Well, it was more than sleeping. It was the concept of becoming dog. If you want to learn, I mean, there's no substitute for personal inspection at zero altitude in life, really. That's the best possible way to learn something. And the idea of finding out what a dog is like and how they live and how they think, for instance, they have houses. Each dog has a house and his own little kennel. And you would be amazed at how little they go in that house. They sit out in the rain. They love rain, and it never penetrates. So they would sit out in the rain, and they don't understand why you don't want to be in the rain. If it's rainy, it doesn't bother them. Well, then why would you have to go to the house? So I would just put on rain gear then, and stay out there with them and work and do things. And they finally they become part of how you think, and I think you become part of how they think.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a short break. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Gary Paulson. For many years, he's been writing books for children, and his latest book is called Winter Dance, and it's about the time he ran the Iditarod in Alaska, and he did it twice in 1983 and again in 1985. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with writer Gary Paulson about his experiences running the Iditarod in Alaska. So how did you prepare yourself for this 1,200-mile run? I mean, are there books written about how to survive the Iditarod?
I don't think, At the time, I called two different people. One of them told me to wear mucklucks and then hung up.
What are mucklucks?
Mucklucks is the kind of footgear that keeps your feet warm, but that's all he told me. This is a man who had run the race. He says, yeah, you better wear mucklucks, and click, that was it. And the other guy I called who had run the race said, get good dogs. I mean, that's it. And that was my sum total of advice. I then started just trying to glean whatever I could anywhere. There are books, I think, now from people who and pamphlets and stuff from people who run, but in 83, when I ran my first race, a lot of that didn't exist. Mm-hmm. Now you have to have qualifying races, too. But then you didn't have to. You could just go run the... In fact, the first race I ever ran was the Iditarod.
Well, the race begins in Anchorage and ends in Nome. And you were voted least likely to get out of Anchorage. And I'd love to have you tell us what the start of the race looked like for you. What the observers saw.
I drew position number 32 to leave the chutes, and I had never been in a race, so I had a trapline leader named Cookie, who was a wonderful leader, but she'd never been in a race either. So I decided somebody had given me a dog named Wilson, who was a sweet dog but not inordinately intelligent, and they had said he was a race leader, so I put him on in the front just because I thought he would be good. And he got us out of the chutes, great, but you go four blocks and then you turn right and you kind of weave through town to get out, and he just blew a hole through the crowd, and we didn't even try the turn. I mean, he just was going everywhere, and I was going, I saw way more of Anchorage than most mushers see. I was wandering around. I'd have to ask people where the Iditarod Trail was, this full dog team with all my gear on it. God, it was just embarrassing.
Were you in control in any way of your team of dogs?
No, not at all. I couldn't stop them. I couldn't slow them down. Wilson was just going ape. He had a great time, and we went through people's yards and stuff. It was just awful. And finally, I hooked a stop sign, and got the sled stopped, and then I put Cookie back in the front end, and I had really good control with her, and she got us out of town okay.
You say the race is about caring for the dogs.
What do they
need, and how do you take care of them in this 17, 18, 19, 20-day run?
you take constant care of their feet. You rub ointment in their feet every chance you get. Different types of, like Vaseline is one of the good ones. And then you put booties on them so that their feet don't get sore, depending on the dog. Some dogs don't need booties. Many do. You feed them. In my case, I fed almost every 40 minutes, literally. And so I would go up the line and snack them every 40 minutes. And then you watch them, and if they get even a little tired, you stop and rest them. I mean, it's just this constant. I've talked to guys who have run that whole race and never looked at the scenery and never seen anything but their dogs. They never look up. They just watch their dogs all the time taking care of them.
When do you begin to lose track of time when you're running the Iditarod?
Probably by the second or third day. You don't sleep normally. In fact, the Iditarod is an altering experience. You never sleep normally again.
Really?
I still don't. Yeah, I still
And this
don't.
Is 10 years later.
Yeah, I don't sleep more than 4 hours a night. I still don't. And when I wake up, I listen for my dogs. By the second or third day, usually you're out of touch with what the world is, and you're only in touch with the dogs and what you're trying to do.
Were you able to take in the terrain, or were you busy watching your dogs?
My first race, I took I carried a camera because I had a lot of sponsors that never believed I would get there, and they were really sweet people, and so I took 750 slides going across. But most of them are no good because I was being dragged on my face or falling off cliffs and stuff. But anyway, I wound up with about 80 slides that are really pretty, and there's about 20 of them in the book, as a matter of fact. I put some in the book. But generally, you don't look at anything but dogs. You really don't. A lot of the pictures I took, I just hold the camera up, and I didn't even look through it. I click it and hope that something was on there.
Were you able to get little cat naps?
You rest, but you kind of do it with your eyes open. You rest, your body goes into a rest state sometimes, but you don't really sleep. It's not a normal type sleep. You don't get REM sleep ever, I don't think, in the race.
When did the hallucinations start?
In my case, they start the third night, perhaps earlier in the second night, but I think it was the third night. And they were very involved. I had guys riding on my sled. I would talk to them. I would see naked women. At one point, a whole village I was in, and people waving at me and telling me to let the dogs go. They'd catch them. And God, I was so glad. It was like a checkpoint. And it was all in my head. All in my head. And I think the hallucinations don't ever end. It's just that in 85, I learned to control them a little so that I would kind of know that it was a hallucination, but I'd go ahead and have it anyway.
But you had a little, in 85, there was a voice that said, here they come again. Here come those hallucinations.
Yeah, you would say, well, here's one, and somebody would be sitting on your sled talking to you. And so I would kind of talk to him, and I knew it was insane, but it kind of got me through the moment. I've talked to people who have let their sleds go, thinking that somebody was there to catch them and stuff.
So hallucinations are pretty common then during the Iditarod.
Oh, everybody. I mean, everybody that I know have spoken to has had them. Even the people who have won the race many times still, I think, have them at night. In my case, it was between midnight and 3 or 4 in the morning, somewhere in there. Sometimes up to 5 in the morning was the worst time.
Gary Paulson is my guest, and we're talking about his running of the Iditarod, which he did back in the 80s, and he's written a book about it called Winter Dance. When you got close to the end of the race, did your mind change? I mean, did you feel somehow, or your mood change, realizing that you were going to make it?
No. When I was about 25 miles out, you run on a beach the last 40 miles, and I got in late at night. I got in at 9:30, so it was dark. And I could see the lights hours before I got there. I could see Nome. And lights you don't see in the race. You just never see lights. It's something we're not used to down here, but up in Alaska, the whole interior is not lighted. And so you're so used to darkness that when you see all these lights in the distance, it just seems so... seemed like a major city. I think Nome's got 3,000 people. It just seemed like, God, it was New York up there. And I didn't want to go in. I didn't want to be with people.
Why not?
I'd found a kind of solitude and beauty, and I still have some of that, by God. I really do.
You got into Nome?
I stopped about 20 miles out. I stopped, and 18 miles maybe or something. I stopped, and I stood there looking. I decided I'd go back. I decided I'd just not go in. And there was another man running near me, and he stopped and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I think I'll turn around." And he said, "No, you got to finish. You don't get your buckle," he says, "unless you finish." You get a belt buckle, you know. And I think maybe that was one of the things. I thought, well, I ought to get my buckle, you know. So, I mean, you have to understand, my mind was completely fried by this time. I was just gone. But a lot of that that wishing for solitude still mm-hmm. exists in me. Mm-hmm. I'm out here in California right now restoring a sailboat that I'll probably do some solitude on.
So when you got into Nome in the middle of the night, anyone there to cheer you across the finish line?
Yes, my wife and son were there, and they had flown up, and Cookie didn't want to. We got to 12 feet from the finish line, and there was a big crowd there and people yelling and stuff, so she stopped. And then she sat.
The same feeling you had, right?
Yeah, she just sat down, and so I went up and helped her get, I grabbed her harness, and we went across together. And then somebody took my dogs, and you have to understand, during the race, nobody touches your dogs. I mean, that's just never, you just don't do that. And they have these mushers, Iditarod mushers, who take your dogs because you can't think right. And they put your dogs on beds, and your handler's there, you know, taking care of things. So all this was going on. And I turned away. When I turned back, the dogs were gone. Hmm. And there was a man right in my face. And he said, welcome to Nome or something. And I said, "Where's my dogs?" And he said, "Don't worry about you." I said, "I want my dogs now." And I was going to hit him. It was the mayor of Nome, Leo Rasmussen, welcoming me to Nome. I was just completely gone. My wife came up really quick. She was standing there, and she said, Ruth said, "It's okay, it's okay. It's okay, we'll go to the dogs." So she took me down to the dogs. And I crawled around in the straw with them, petting them and thanking them for the run. And she stood with her hand on my head crying because she thought I was permanently insane. and actually, I probably was. And, I mean, it's an altering experience.
Well, you end your book with another chapter in your life. You were in Boston and looked like you had a heart attack or something close to that. And you were told that you'd have to live a, quote, more normal life, and you'd have to give up the dogs.
God, that was rough.
You also write, "How can I live without my dogs?" Do you live without your dogs now?
I had a friend named Mark Nordman who came and got him. And he got it all. I mean, he got the sleds, everything, and it was nice that he did. But I'll give you an idea how strong this pull is. Last year, I went up to northern Minnesota and ran dogs again to see if I could. And about 5 weeks ago, I went up to Michigan, the Upper Peninsula, and ran dogs.
Do you get the same feeling at all from writing that you get from running with your dogs?
I do. I love writing in many ways similar to how I love the dogs. I love writing the way you love, so that when I'm working on a story, if it's working right, the hair goes up on my neck. It's very exciting. And I work as hard at writing as I did with dogs, too.
The subtitle of your book is "The Fine Madness of Running the Iditarod." Do you like losing your mind?
I think it's wonderful to push the limits, to push the boundary of the performance envelope or whatever. I think there's a great beauty in that artistically. I don't think completely losing it is a good thing, but to get on that edge when you're working in the arts, I think is very important, and to function on that edge, I think it's vital, and I think there's not many people doing it now.
Well, Gary Paulson, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful being here.
Gary Paulson's book about running the Iditarod in 1983 is called Winter Dance. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. Coming up, the next generation of gay playwrights. David Drake's biggest influence as a young gay man in the 80s was Larry Kramer's play, The Normal Heart. Now he's written his own play, The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me. Coming up, Drake performs excerpts from the play and talks about growing up gay. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Ref, starring MTV's Dennis Leary as a cat burglar who takes hostage the family from hell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The Whitewater investigation entered a new phase today with the testimony of several White House aides before a federal grand jury in Washington. The staff members were to tell the grand jury about any contacts they had had with regulators looking into the Clintons' role in a failed Arkansas real estate deal. Meanwhile, the White House delivered a stack of documents related to Whitewater to the special counsel. President Clinton spoke out on crime today in Brooklyn, New York. The president said Americans have to learn to be good neighbors again to take back their streets. He said times have changed from when calling the police was an adequate response to crime.
Today, even that is not enough. We have to help, each and every one of us, to reclaim our streets, our schools, our communities, and our lives. This is not a call for blind heroics, but practical action if we want to save our own citizenship.
The president also mentioned his national service plan as a way for young people to help their communities. Congressman Henry Waxman has asked the Justice Department to look into whether tobacco companies broke the law by failing to report extra amounts of nicotine in cigarettes. Waxman said federal law requires cigarette makers to report all ingredients added to tobacco. News reports and the FDA have charged that companies put in extra nicotine to make smokers more addicted to cigarettes. The Fleet Financial Group, the nation's 15th largest bank, has announced plans to trim its workforce by thousands. Kathleen Burke reports from Providence, Rhode Island.
Fleet Chairman Terrence Murray says by cutting 5,500 positions and 3,000 employees, Fleet will better be able to control costs. And he says the banking giant will also become more competitive and will be better able to serve its customers. The seven-month Fleet Focus, which recommends the cutbacks, also promises savings of some $350 million annually. The cutbacks affect several northeastern states. In Rhode Island, 325 positions will be cut. Massachusetts loses 550, Connecticut 400, with the rest in New York, Maine, and New Hampshire. Murray says while the cuts are regrettable and personally painful, he believes if they didn't happen, ultimately, more jobs might have been at risk. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathleen Burke in Providence.
Palestinian sources reportedly say that PLO leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin will meet in Washington sometime within the next 2 weeks. But first, the sources tell the Associated Press, the UN would have to condemn the recent Hebron massacre of Palestinians by a Jewish gunman. The meeting could put the Israeli PLO peace talks back on track after they were jeopardized by the recent Hebron killings. Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 22.79 to end the day at 3830.62. Declines led advances. This is NPR. The country's savings and loan industry made a profit again last year. The government's Office of Thrift Supervision says the 1,600 thrifts that survived the S&L crisis made a total of $5 billion. The office attributes the profits to the wide gap between the interest depositors earn and what people with loans pay. It also says the number of delinquent loans and problem assets has dropped. The UN says one of its relief convoys has turned back after being blocked for 4 days by Serbian troops outside the Bosnian Muslim town of Maglaj. Residents have been cut off from aid for 5 months, except for sporadic airdrops from American planes. Martin Dawes of the BBC spent a few days in Maglaj, and he says most people are surviving on one meal of beans a day.
The only things Maglaj gets from the world, said one man, are shells and promises. Maglai is an enclave that feels totally betrayed. The last United Nations aid convoy to get in was last October. Another is trying to negotiate his way through Bosnian Serb lines. It's badly needed. American airdrops have been getting some food in, but UN aid agencies calculate 30% of the estimated 19,000 population is malnourished. The dark shadows under the eyes and grey pallor of the majority bear witness to considerable deprivation. The number of amputees is striking. People have been under a sustained artillery assault for 9 months. They say it escalated at the end of February. The mayor, Aida Smejic, said, "We want the United Nations to give Maglai the Sarajevo solution so that the guns are moved away and the blockade is broken."
Martin Dawes for the BBC. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says he doesn't plan to meet with Chinese dissidents during his upcoming visit to China. News reports said Christopher might talk with prominent activist Wei Jingsheng, but at a news conference in Tokyo today, Christopher said he had no plans to do so. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. David Drake received an Obie for his 1992 one-man play, The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me. Larry Kramer is a playwright, gay activist, and founder of ACT UP. Drake wrote his play after seeing Kramer's The Normal Heart, which documented the early effects of AIDS on the gay community and politicized Drake into activism. Drake's play explores the many facets of gay life: AIDS, homophobia, politics, sexuality, love. It's both confessional and a call to action. Drake has appeared in a number of movies, including Longtime Companion, Philadelphia, and Naked in New York. His play, The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me, is now out in paperback. Let's begin with a reading from the play.
My 22nd birthday, June 27th, 1985. The night I went to see a play, one that I had heard was gay, that held the promise of a real live kiss from a real live Brad Davis upon the lips of a real live man. That's the kiss that I wanted to see, but not the one that stayed and stayed and stayed with me after June 27th, 1985, the night Larry Kramer kissed me with his play, The Normal Heart. That shot through a loose cannon mouth and exploded my soul into 1,000 teardrop deaths, leaving my eyes bruised from the damp fingerprints off of my public theater playbill and from the cradling palms that smeared my snot-run face with black ink blood. The same stains I wiped daily from my New York Times hands and face. From the pages, 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 I snapped past to find the news. All the news that wasn't there on A1. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. 21, 22. On B1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. That was not fit on C1. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. To print on D1. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Stop. Ballet dancer, 32. Dead. The night after the night Larry Kramer kissed me, I threw down those pages, pages, pages from my New York Times and ran for days to escape the invisible, unprintable killer stalking me.
That's David Drake reading from his play, The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me. Now, what was it about seeing Larry Kramer's play, The Normal Heart, that made you think differently about yourself?
I began to see myself. I was 22 then, and I'm 30 now. Inside of a context that I didn't know existed. I think at that time I was young. I was 22. I was new to New York. My first year in New York City. I was an aspiring actor. Well, I was working and things, but I was I was gay to my friends and openly to them and to myself, but I compartmentalized it in a way that I didn't see it as relevant in the world at large. I didn't know anybody who had AIDS. I didn't know anybody who admitted they were living with HIV. I didn't know anybody who could say those words and understand them. Once again, it seemed very abstract to me until people started dying a few years later, and then I began to see what it was. By that point, I had been tested and tested negative. I was having safe sex, is what we called it then, or safer sex, but the whole idea of sex was very scary to me. I wouldn't touch anybody. I knew how it was passed along. I was educated enough even in like 86, 87, but I'd rather take all my energy and put it into my work. I was just afraid. I thought, and I felt a lot of judgment on myself.
Mm-hmm. You brought a lot of judgment on yourself.
Yeah. You know, the punishment judgment, the struggle with, am I bad? You know, is this the payoff for being gay? You know, not understanding those things.
How did that creep into your conversation, though, that somehow being gay was a punishment for something? Because certainly we hear that from people outside the gay movement, but how did those fears creep into your thoughts?
Because I think in recalling early childhood experiences, I was punished for exhibiting anything that was other than my biological role as a male. I was a sissy boy, and it was a very shameful thing for me.
A sissy boy, meaning a boy that played with girls, played with dolls?
Yes. I liked to play with dolls. I liked, I didn't like team sports or playing sports in those ways. And I've come to understand that as there's other dimensions going on, even when you're a small child with your playmates, that's not necessarily going to be acted out on. It's just there are dynamics of comfortability with other boys or other girls, and there was always a tension with other boys that I wanted to be the little girl who ran away, but I didn't want to be a girl. But those are the only ideas we've got going. We've got boys and girls, straight.
Were your parents concerned about you playing with dolls and playing with girls?
Yes and no. I think my parents divorced when I was 7. I don't have a weak father. I have a very strong father, and to counter that often used time-honored argument of the powerful mother,
it's
the weak
aha.
Father. Aha, look, his gender roles are all screwed up. Look, the mother's too powerful for her own good. Down, you woman! Come on, man, carry a gun. Well, my dad does carry a gun. He's an outdoor sports writer for many newspapers all over Pennsylvania, and Dave Dracula, he writes a column, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, mm-hmm. He's got a magazine. He's a big man of the big woods. State game commissioner. I got a BB gun and I wanted a Barbie as a child, and that is the truth. He was understanding. He's also a teacher. My mother was a teacher, too. She was a music teacher. They were both educated people, mm-hmm. but they were young parents. They were 20 when they had me, and they didn't, when I came out to them, it's similar to what it's explored in the play, comically, but truthfully, I wanted to distill the experience of coming out so that I could tell that to people. I didn't want to moan and groan through the coming out experience. I'll write that in the memoir.
I'm talking with playwright David Drake about his one-man play, The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Playwright David Drake is my guest. You have played drag queens, or you've been in drag on stage.
That's right. There's a difference in those two things.
Yeah.
Actually,
well, tell us what the difference is.
Well, I've done two plays in cross-dressing and drag to playing a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Playing a woman. I played in Vampire Lesbians of Sodom I replaced Charles Bush, who wrote it, and I did it for a year and a half, and then I left did a lot of regional theater, and then I came back. It was like that job that I could always count on, Vampire Lesbians of Sodom. And that was playing a woman in Act One. I played a fashion designer in London, sort of a Mary Quant spoof there. And then in Act Two, Vampire Lesbians, I was a very grand thing. But I knew the audience knew that I was in a dress.
Sure.
And they knew I was a man playing a woman. But when you're on stage, I didn't know that. I mean, I knew that, but I didn't consciously go, wink, wink, guess what? I'm Robin Williams and Mrs. Doubtfire.
I read that one of your role models was Stella Stevens.
Yes.
60s sex pot, right?
She had the most bite. I did. She had anger. Stella Stevens in the Poseidon Adventure is like, you know, air pockets. You know, she had all
Which
this anger.
She
was Miss Linda Rogo. She was married to Ernest Borgnine. She was the very glamorous sort of blonde one, sort of cheap. And I loved her. I thought she spoke for me. I saw the Poseidon Adventure 13 times as a child.
For her.
Well, I love the movie. And, you know, what a metaphor. A life turned upside down, survival. We're going through the maze of it. I mean, come on. That's pretty easy for a little queer boy. But I loved her because she was a sort of angry and biting current edition of Barbie. Marilyn, you know, these images of femininity that I have been told my mother was blonde, but she wasn't like Stella Stevens, but she was blonde and she was pretty. And I think I, you know, I saw that as an image of mother Barbie Stella. I
wow.
don't know, but I loved
but
all of her movies. Oh, and she
that.
Made dreadful movies, and I taped every single one of them. I would tape them on a tape recorder on TV and then listen to them because I loved her.
Has your father seen you perform?
Yes, he's seen the show twice. He came in for opening night.
What did he say?
He's very proud of me. This was an opportunity to go. You know, I'm my father's son, except I'm doing it within my own experience in life and what I feel passionate about, and trying to make some sort of dramatic creation out of understanding those experiences. And he's very proud. He likes the Vigil piece in the show very much. Which were you talking about? AIDS informing my life. That is the piece in this play. It's called 1,000 Points of Light, and it gives a little meaning to that phrase from Noonan's speech for George Bush. It is six stories that there's a question that's being asked in it, and I ask it myself, and I think a lot of people ask the question, where did you go mm-hmm. when you lose somebody, whether it's to AIDS or whatever? My mother, where did you go? I think, oh, she's still in Maryland. You know, this is very specifically about the gay men and AIDS.
Why don't we close with a section from The 1,000 Points of Light?
Yes. Paul. Paul. Paul, you singing, dancing, new age, let go, gypsy, chorus boy, queen. God, I loved you. And boy, I should have known you'd leap to tour when I suggested that maybe our dating was moving toward a relationship. Oh, no, 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 you said. You said, I have a career. You've got to let go, let go, let go, you said, 'cause God, I'm a dancer and a dancer dances. Oh, you people-pleasing tease. But who kept calling from those midnight motel rooms on the road? You, not me. You who closed in Phoenix and called me at 3 a.m. saying, help. What do I do? Come here, Paul. Come home. Okay, 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 you said, but before New York, I've got to see my family. Soon. 2 months passed, Paul, too. Where the hell did you go? Except for that picture postcard of the St. Louis airport that said, soon, Paul, I didn't hear a damn thing from you. Soon. Soon? Yeah, soon the phone rang. It was Tanya in Harrisburg, PA, your sister, saying, you're the friend, you better come, soon. I was so mad at you, Paul. I waited a week before I got on that train for Harrisburg. You bounced around the country for the past 11 months in those two-horse towns for those deadbeat hicks who never heard of HIV, never gave a thought about that beautiful young man kicking and belting his guts out up there on that stage to win their attention, win their approval, win their praise without a heartbeat of a glimmer, of a pause, of a thought that that beautiful young man's blood coursed with the poison that was drilling his life away. Every second up there on that damn stage. Those selfish bastards and their selfish taste for escape. Escape! What do they need to escape from? Oh, God, to this minute I still hate musicals. And every time I even mention seeing a doctor, blood work, T-cells, counts, anything, Paul, you shooed me away with that giving in to the negative, giving into the dis-ease ball. You had so much energy, Paul. Where did it go? Soon. Harrisburg. In that night, in that room, holding your hand, I sat by your side, and though our hands held contained, baby, you did not. Rather, you seemed all over the room, wandering, gently, cautiously, in a moment, suddenly, quietly, of silence. You got away. Where did you go? I went through the weekend, and the family, and the food, and the flowers, and the phone calls, and the viewing, and the viewing, and the viewing, and the viewing, and don't Catholics believe in cremation? What? And the neighbors, and the priest, and your mother's introduction, Paul's friend, and Tanya's insistence, Paul's lover. And the whispers, you would have been furious. And the stares, but I loved it. Let go, I did. And the limo, what did you tell her, Paul? I was your lover? And the limo? And the lowering? Why? And the dirt? Is that how you told me? We carry the dead.
David Drake, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Drake's one-man play, The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me, is now out in paperback. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about some of the stories they'll be covering on the show. Linda, what do you have for us?
Marty, there will be apparently a new head of the Civil Rights Division. The president's candidate appears to be clearing Congress with very few problems. That's the job that has not been filled since President Clinton attempted to nominate Lonnie Guinier to the post. Also, Senator Chafee was here earlier today to tell us about his plans to reform the health care system. The first journalist into Maglai, the town which is still under siege, though the siege of Sarajevo has now been lifted, describes conditions there, and we'll hear from a 13-year-old Bosnian child about a day in her life in Sarajevo.
Linda, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Performer Dennis Leary started getting attention a couple of years back with his one-man show, No Cure for Cancer, which was a hit off Broadway in New York. That led to appearances on MTV. Chain-smoking and praising Cindy Crawford to the skies, his unusual blend of comedian and leather-jacketed tough guy hit a nerve. Then the movie snapped him up, but mainly as a villain. Now in his first real starring role, he plays a criminal again, but this time with a somewhat more sympathetic tone. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of The Ref.
Right, I thought it was a sports movie too. But The Ref is a dark comedy of domestic manners, and in its way it's cleverly titled. Dennis Leary plays Gus, a thief who finds himself stuck in the Connecticut suburbs with the wrong hostages, Lloyd and Caroline, to be exact, a couple who are so busy bickering that they don't know enough to be scared. Instead of getting to order them around and take all their money, Gus winds up having to referee their spats, a job he's good and sick of almost from the moment he enters their house at gunpoint and has a look around.
Nice. You rich?
No. Oh, God, no.
Not really.
No.
Antiques like this ain't cheap.
Oh, I run an antique store in town. These are all from the shop.
It's his mother's store.
So?
Well, you made it sound like it was yours. You know, I run an antique store.
I did not. I said I run it.
I didn't say I own it.
I am the manager of the place.
Do you think he cares if you work for your mother?
Let's get one thing straight, okay? From now on, the only person who yells is me. Why? Because I have a gun, okay? People with guns can do whatever they want. Married people without guns, for instance, you. Do not get to yell. Why? No guns. No guns. No yelling. See? Simple little equation.
That's Judy Davis as Caroline and Kevin Spacey as Lloyd. And terrific casting is this movie's most glittering asset. In the spoiled, brittle, and restless department, Judy Davis currently has no peer. Her tempo is racier than anybody else's. And you can feel her impatience when the rest of the world fails to spin at her speed. Kevin Spacey's role is harder to play, because Lloyd is such a bland mama's boy. But Spacey is always a still, coiled presence, and he manages to lend Lloyd an unexpected mystery. You know he'll eventually reveal hidden depths, and Spacey keeps you on edge waiting. Lloyd and Caroline are a handful, but Gus has other troubles. His inept partner is off trying to heist a boat, and meanwhile it's Christmas Eve, and all of Lloyd and Caroline's ghastly relatives are about to descend for dinner. In the end, Gus has to pose as a marriage counselor and sit through a drunken Scandinavian feast with these monsters, all of which, unfortunately, ought to be a lot funnier than it is. We've been here before. The Ref is reminiscent at various times of ruthless people in Home Alone, and like those movies, it owes a lot to the classic O. Henry story The Ransom of Red Chief. But once the premise is established, the film has only two directions to go. It can go dark and scary, or it can go soft. With Walt Disney distributing, you can guess which slippery slope The Ref tumbles down. The movie gets slurpier with every successive scene. The director, Ted Demme, who is Jonathan Demme's nephew, can handle comedy smartly. He's the guy who directed all those Dennis Leary spots on MTV. But he can't do much with the movie's central thudding irony, that Lloyd and Caroline are living the comfortable life that Gus has always dreamed of, only they're miserable. Besides, Dennis Leary is too confident and graceful to convince us he's the down-and-out loser he's meant to portray. Leary has lounge lizard looks, an air of bohemian alienation, and a mean way with a cigarette. The Ref isn't the best vehicle for him, but he still comes out of it looking like a star.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Vablaitis and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moskowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, back to the archives. We talk with A.E. Hotchner. His memoir about childhood misadventures during the Depression was the basis for the film King of the Hill. Also, Andrew Davis, who directed The Fugitive. Both films have just come out on video. I'm Marty Moskowane. Join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.